I'll just start by introducing our panellists. First of all, my name's Clementine Ford. I'm a feminist columnist and writer for Daily Life and Fairfax, and I will be the MC this evening. To my left is Alice Pung. Alice Pung is the best-selling author of Lorinda, which has been long-listed for the 2015 Stella Prize. Very deservedly, might I say, as well. It's an excellent book, and I highly recommend everyone go out and buy it immediately to read. Her father's daughter won the 2012 Western Australia Premier's Literary Awards, and she also wrote the memoir Unpolished Gem, which won the 2007 Australian Book Industry Newcomer of the Year Award. She's also the editor of Growing Up Asian in Australia and has had stories and articles published in Good Weekend, Mianjin, The Monthly Age and The Best Australian Stories. Please welcome Alice Pung. In the middle, we have Karina Quinn, who is a Melbourne-based poet, writer, spoken word performer and researcher, and is the managing editor of the interdisciplinary, peer-reviewed Gender, Sexuality and Diversity Studies journal, Writing From Below. She is also the 2013 Hairhole Grand Slam winner. She writes about birth, breastfeeding, surgery, sex, trauma, tattoos, scars and everything in between. When she's not writing, Karina works as a sign language interpreter, where her body still gets to tell stories, just not on a page. Please welcome Karina. And finally, I'd like to introduce you to Kelly Jean Drinkwater. Kelly Jean is an artist, performer and filmmaker recognised internationally for her work in radical body politics. The main focus of her creative practice is to critique society's perceptions of people of size and to encourage a diverse body positive visibility. Always challenging and often confrontational, her work aims to investigate the complex and the taboo. She is currently in production on a collaborative documentary film based on Nothing to Lose, the production which is opening here at the Malthouse on the 11th of March. And this documentary will be due for release in 2015. Please welcome Kelly Jean. Now, I'd just like to issue a standard kind of disclaimer before we begin this discussion. We talked about this a little bit up in the green room, and that's just the acknowledgement that even though we're four women here who represent very different kind of backgrounds, we certainly are not aiming to represent everyone's background, and you know, we don't all represent the individual kind of brackets that we come from either. So we acknowledge that there's a lot of diversity to this topic. Not everything that we say will be the experiences of everyone else out there, and not everything that we say will necessarily be things that people agree with, but that's okay. We're just here to have a discussion, and we just wanted to acknowledge that from the outset, that we understand the limits of how far this discussion can go with only four people here. So I'd just like to begin by asking Kelly Jean just to give us some background on Nothing to Lose, because that's what really prompted this whole discussion tonight.
Yeah, so Nothing to Lose is a dance theatre piece that I've been working on for the last 2.5 years with Force Majeure and Kate Champion. So they're a Sydney-based dance theatre company. And Nothing to Lose is a dance movement piece that is a cast of undeniably large bodies, exploring what it means to move and to physicalise and dance in a fat body. So we've just had an incredible sellout season in Sydney at Sydney Festival, and I've been in Melbourne for the last 5 days rehearsing down here, and we're bringing the show here in like 10 days or something like that, and we're in this very theatre. So it's a show that investigates the fat experience. It's movement based, but it's also you know, we look at all sorts of facets of what it means to be living in a fat body.
I think that there's obviously a lot of scope for discussion around the perceptions of beauty and bodies, mm-hmm. and you know, obviously very conventionally attractive bodies are a very limited kind of body type, and fat bodies tend to exist or be perceived to exist outside of that. Mm. But one thing I wanted to ask you was the perception not just of the beauty of fat bodies, but the perception that fat bodies cannot be athletic and cannot dance and cannot move in a way that other bodies can. And clearly you challenge that.
Yeah, I mean, the very nature of the show is so controversial that, you know, when you say sort of a show with fat dancers, people kind of stop and give you an eyebrow. And then, you know, one of the things I loved about when Kate Champion approached me about doing this piece is that she had, you know, she's a very well-known choreographer, and she's been working for many years as a dancer herself and then also in creating work. And she was completely disinterested in trying to get bigger bodies to perform movement in a way that we have seen before, or trying to get bigger bodies to sort of, you know, squeeze into this kind of narrative dance vocabulary of what is considered dance. She was really interested in bringing out the inherent movement of bigger bodies and what that means and how we engage with ourselves as bigger people, where our gravity is, how we hold our bodies, our posture, what that means. And I think that's really, really interesting. And that was one of the reasons why I was so honoured and keen to work on this show. And she's very collaborative with our dancers. So, it's been... it's interesting, when we first started, a lot of the conversations we had were around beauty and what is considered beauty. But luckily for us, we managed to find a cast of people that are all very, very queer, actually. A whole cast of queer people that have their own sort of identity politics and have investigated what that means and how limiting framing the conversation around fat bodies just on beauty. I mean, I think that, you know... this isn't a show about redefining beauty. It's a show about the fat experience and what that means. And we're kind of, I think quite often when you investigate or talk about bigger bodies and sort of fat politics, it's quite often very, it's framed in very sort of ways that are very known and very easy. So usually there's the beauty discussion, there's the health discussion. And then, you know, there's the sort of, I don't know, like the mental health discussion, I guess, like, you know. What we really wanted to do with this show is to move those conversations on from the very sort of first point of call, if you will, around what people usually try and want to talk about when we talk about big bodies, and actually get into sort of the more complexities around, you know, how we inhabit ourselves and how society impacts us, how the medical industry impacts us. And really investigate those kind of more complex kind of discussions. So that was kind of something that we were keen to do. And it's interesting because it's had such a resonance in the dance community, though, which I think is really great, because I was expecting a lot of resistance from what people considered dance communities. And, you know, I can now say that I'm a professional dancer, which is kind of hilarious, and also something I never ever thought I could say ever, but I say it often now, which is really funny. But I think that is what's exciting to me about this work, is that we're actually challenging what a dancer's body can look like and all of the sort of implications of that. So yeah,
and I think that's really interesting, because obviously the theme of tonight's discussion is about the language that we use around bodies and the stereotypes of what that language kind of throws up for people. So when you were talking and you mentioned dancer's body a couple of times, and I thought of how, particularly in my own experience, you know, I grew up, I was always very kind of big boned, and never felt like there were options for me outside of this kind of body that I had. And when I think of the term dancer's body, I think of someone very lithe and long and slender and a sort of an option that is completely off limits to me. Mm. So in challenging the idea of dancer's body and in also saying that the focus of your work is really not to redefine beauty, because that does seem to be where a lot of mainstream attention on fat activism projects seems to kind of fix itself on, and actually just saying, well, no, this is about humanising and offering a deep three-dimensional perspective, regardless of whether or not you think I'm beautiful or not, I think sounds like what might be the crux of the power of the piece.
Yeah, I think that the reason it's had such resonance with audiences and media are fascinated, we've had so much international attention, and I think the difference is that it's not just a discussion about, like, aren't we pretty? Like, you know, it's not just about being pretty and beautiful.
Or asking to be... to be accepted as beautiful.
Yeah, like, we don't really care. You know, it's not about that. It's about, there's an authenticity and an ownership and an embodiment in the work that goes beyond those easy kind of ports of call. And it's more about being, really investigating the other potential of what it is. You know, I think for me, I've always loved dance. It's been my favourite kind of one of my favourite art forms. And I find that the idea, like watching something that's, you know, just pretty and beautiful, incredibly boring. Like I usually just fall asleep. So I'm more interested in pushing things outside of these really narrow kind of parameters that we consider to be something that is aesthetically pleasing. I think something that is incredibly, what would be considered grotesque is more aesthetically pleasing and interesting to me as an artist than what would be considered beautiful. So, yeah.
Karina, with that in mind about this idea of the body beautiful and the acceptance of beauty, particularly in terms of activism, something that has frustrated me in the past is this sort of, this asking that women seem to do to be considered beautiful and to be to have the limits of objectification kind of widened, rather than sort of saying, well, no, I just actually just want to be allowed to live my life as I want to live it. Is there a liberation in being a queer, quite unfemme? I don't know if you identify as butch, but is there a liberation in being able to kind of exist outside of that? Or do you feel in some ways like you're not even entitled to want to be a part of that?
I struggle every day to exist outside of that, really, which is hard. I've just been working on that a lot myself. So every day I need to talk to myself about how it is okay to be in the body that I'm in, to present the way that I do, to be mistaken for a man a lot of the time, and to be really fine with that. The thing that's not fine is when I go, no, you know, they go, sorry, mate. And I go, no worries. And they're like, oh, no, I'm really sorry. And I'm like, it's really okay. And in fact, one guy kept going on about it so much that I just went, I can't even talk to you about this anymore. I can't even tell you how fine it is. And we just, you'd have to stop talking. He's like, I'm so sorry. It just went on. It was terrible. It just went on and on and on. But I guess the thing for me is So I had two babies. I've had polycystic ovarian syndrome most of my life, which means I get big very quickly. And I, after my second baby, decided that I needed to toe the party line and be slim. And there's a real aesthetic with butch dykes or, I don't know, genderqueer boys or whatever you want to call it. I've not really fitted myself into something. I know the category of woman broadly doesn't work for me, but I'm not heading to some other end of things. That we're supposed to be very slim and not have breasts and present in a certain way. And so I did that, and then I had a hysterectomy, and then I lost an ovary, and then another one got stitched to the inside of my pelvic wall. And that happened over the 3 years I decided to write an autobiography of my body. So I called that surgery as field trip, which was a really nice way of thinking about it. And in fact, when I woke up from my hysterectomy, a very good friend who was also a PhD student at the time sat next to me and took notes about what I was saying as I came to and took photographs of me, which was great, actually. It was really helpful. But what happened from that is that I then put on weight again and then had doctors tell me I had to go on meal replacements and I had to lose lots of weight. And I've just come to, I don't have to lose weight to be okay in the world. It's okay to take up space, like it's okay to rub up against the person next to me on the tram. And realising that I have repetitive, intrusive, really cruel thoughts about being worth less as a person because I'm not a size 10. And that shits me to tears. Mm. And I grew up with lesbians. Like, I grew up with these amazing kind of out there, strong, hairy-legged, Amazon-type women in the 70s and 80s who just went, we're not doing that. Mm. And I still managed to take all of those messages from the world and from the world that I live in and decide that it was not okay to present the way that I am. So that's been a big deal for me lately.
Ah, thank you. Thank you.
I love that you mentioned the fear of taking up space, and I know, Kelly Jean, you'll have a lot to say about that as well. this idea that somehow one of the reasons why women especially are expected to be small and quiet and thin. I mean, even before we were discussing, when we were doing the little tech thing, I was saying how I've often noticed in doing panels that women are quite hesitant to speak directly into a microphone. you know, particularly women who aren't used to doing public speaking will kind of sort of try and speak off to the side like this, and if they do go in front of the microphone, they'll speak really quietly. And part of that is this sort of internalised idea that women's voices even have to shrink and not take up space, but also this fear of being accused of shrillness and hysteria. And so everything that we kind of take on board from a very, very young age is this idea that women have to move through the world in a way that's slinking against the walls, that's not actually announcing our presence wherever we go, and certainly is not intruding on anyone else's space at all. And so I just want to take that kind of perspective to Alice, because I think that the sort of racially driven perceptions of Asian women, I mean, initially starting with the fact that Asian women are all homogenised into one group, but also the perspective that Asian women and the Orientalist kind of view of that is that it's your very nature to do that kind of shrinking to make men feel. I'm not saying that these are my views at all, but I have lived in Japan and witnessed white men who live there as well, and the way that they treat Japanese women. How have you noticed that throughout your life and in challenging that as well? I mean, particularly in Lorinda, the way that your main character behaves is this sort of like quite drastic two sides of the one coin, and one is the sort of idea in white society of being the obedient young Asian girl, and then her actual personality is completely different to that.
Oh, that's a great question. So Lorinda is partly, it's a novel, but it's partly based on my growing up. I'm going to tell you an interesting story that happened to me recently, which relates to this and relates to the main theme of Lorinda, which is a lot of people pick up on the race theme, but it's got a lot to do with class, and a lot of my gender has to do with class as well. So I grew up in Braybrook, which, as some of you might know, is like, you know, back, even now, it's a socially disadvantaged area. It's full of third or second generation people on welfare, because back in the 1970s, the factories started to get closed down. But anyhow, my husband and I, a couple of months ago, we went to Bunnings Warehouse to just get some things for the that we needed, some pipes. And when we walked back to our car, we parked it in the car park, and there was a little sheet of paper on the windscreen, and I thought we got a fine, but then I thought, no, we can't get a fine because we're in the Bunnings car park. And so, you know, he picked it up and he opened it, and I said, what is it? Is it like a nightclub advertisement or something? And he said, I'm going to check if the other cars have this too. And I said, what is it? And so he went around, because I'm pregnant, I sat lazily in the car waiting for him to come back. And he came back and he said, I can't believe this. And I'd never seen him quite upset like this before. He's usually pretty chilled. I said, what is it? And I took it from him and I opened it up. And it was a picture of a white girl and a black boy seen through the barrel of a gun with a cross through them. And it said, stop race mixing. And I thought, whoa, that's pretty, that's kind of, you know, it's look, I'm not sure if my reaction was bizarre. I thought, that's pretty funny. And he didn't find it funny. I said, there's a crazy person that just saw me visibly pregnant, and he must have a whole stack of these. He must have stopped race mixing, stopped queer marriage, stop Jewish people. Who carries this sort of stuff? It was crazy. But I didn't feel threatened. I didn't feel like some crazy person would come out, because it was a cowardly thing to do. They didn't tap me on the shoulder and say, are you, get an abortion. I don't like mixed caste people. You know, that was the point of this, stop race mixing. So anyhow, I talked to my friend Maxine Benever-Clark, who is a writer of Jamaican descent, and I thought she'd find it funny too, but she said, this is horrible. What kind of person goes around sticking this on car windows? And then I realised that my reaction was kind of bizarre, and it wasn't either, because I thought, wow, I've not had this for many years. I've not had someone be so overtly racist towards me. Because growing up in Braybrook, you get that kind of thing a lot. So when the Southeast Asians and Samoans started moving into the Braybrook in the late 1970s and 80s, Braybrook is very proudly working class. It's next to Sunshine, where the minimum wage decision, the harvester decision, was decided. So it was a very proud working class neighbourhood until the recession of 1983. And then so many people lost their jobs. And you didn't see many people of colour on television. You saw them in the newspapers. They looked like my uncles, and they were all drug dealers. My uncles weren't drug dealers, but, you know, you saw Asian mugshots. And so people started to worry about these Asians coming in, because no factory jobs for the poor boys who finished at Toddy Tech at the age of 16. All of a sudden, all these yellow and brown people moving in, they must be stealing jobs. So you did get, I'm afraid to say, this kind of outward hostility. So it wasn't a abnormal thing. Even when I was about six or seven, someone chucked a rock through our window, and my dad, you know, he just pulled down the blind, and instead of fixing the window, he said, "Oh, you know, we'll have some shade." I didn't realise why he did that. He probably didn't want to draw attention. But we never felt unsafe or threatened. It was the way life was. You had the Bogans, and beneath them you had the Bogasians, the Bogan Asians, which were us. So I never felt particularly attractive because people like us were mail order brides, or, you know, you had, because there were Filipino neighbours, and so you were like the lowest of the low. And then when I went to university, suddenly my popularity skyrocketed completely beyond my control, because you had people going to Japan, like the men you met in Japan, people going to Indonesia. You studied intersectionality, you studied gender politics and, you know, Southeast Asian politics. And I thought, hey, people are finding me quite cool, and that has nothing to do with me whatsoever. So anyhow, it doesn't. I was still the same person when I was growing up in Braybrook to when I was at university. Nothing had substantially changed about my interior, but everything had changed, you know? And so what I realised was I didn't feel a threat from this stop race mixing poster. And this sounds so arrogant, because I felt like, you know, I'm a writer, I'm speaking on this panel. That poor person who does these posters probably, you know, doesn't have much of a voice, probably Googles American Southern racist websites where they found this, because that's where it was from, you know. It was from a museum in the deep south, and that was where the poster is from, and it was
A museum.
Well, website and racial purity, there are still people who believe in that kind of thing. So they're just slightly crazy people. But the further I got through university, the more I realised that the racism that affected me a lot more was kind of middle-class racism. And that was because it was so tied in with gender. And there's a certain kind of femininity. People say, oh, Southeast Asian people or Muslim women are so oppressed. But, you know, you grow up in Braybrook, and Muslim women at home, they whack their brothers with brooms, and they're quite... My friends were very loud and outspoken, and the further I got through university, I went to law school, the more you realise that, hey, maybe white Western women with all these media images, this idea of femininity was probably more oppressive than the kind of womanhood I grew up with at home with, you know, my mother. And I watched this SBS show called If You Are The One. Some of you watch that. And you think, hey, you know, the Chinese women are quite feisty in that.
Thank you, Alice. That was a fantastic response. And it's made me think about, you know, particularly in your reference to this sort of like underhanded middle class racism, that you would have been a teenager throughout the Hanson years, Pauline Hanson, and having someone decide so publicly that they know exactly what your experience is obviously the experience as well of a lot of Muslim women now, particularly with commentators who've decided that they know exactly what their experience of life is. But everyone on this panel would have had that experience of other people not from their world deciding that they know what their life is and speaking for them. I'm just wondering if, Kelly Jean, if you can kind of speak to that, particularly in terms of the couching of really just fat phobia as, oh, well, we're just very concerned about their health.
Yes. So, I mean, it is something that I think we all as I mean, I'm speaking from my own experience, but, you know, I think that as bigger people, as fat people, we are bombarded constantly with what we call compassion trolling, which is the well-intended meaning of people who are just really concerned about our health. Mm-hmm. Or just really concerned that we're never going to find true love or happiness, or that we're just going to drop dead any minute now. And, you know, so that's something that happens often. But, I mean, that's the kind of more polite, insidious kind of commentary that we get and judgment around our bodies. But, you know, one of the things that still, constantly overwhelms me is how obvious and really quite... how people feel so they have so much permission to really attack our bodies as not being, having any kind of right to exist. And this assumption that all fat people are in a state of transition, that we're all sort of somewhere on the path of losing, wanting to lose vast amounts of weight, and that we're all, just failing miserably at the constant diets that we're on, and that we're our whole purpose in life is to be smaller than we are. And I think that's something that's really, really fascinating to me, because it really kind of, it's so insulting to intellect and to experience and to everything that we have to offer as human beings, regardless of the shape that our bodies are in. And I think that's something that bowls me over constantly, that it's still such a loud voice in especially mainstream media and in the way that people discuss bodies. It's still people are unapologetically fat hating still to this day. And I think most people kind of know that they probably shouldn't be racist, and most people know that they probably shouldn't be homophobic. But I think people pretty much think they have every right in the world to think that fat people should all go away. And that's something that I find, it's fascinating and it's relentless, and it's a giant source of inspiration for me as a performer.
Well, even to the point where, in any sort of article about plus size fashion, and I really hate the term plus size.
Me too.
And I wanted to talk to you about the labels that we give to sort of... how labels like plus size and curvy are really designed as a way to take the fact out of what being fat is, that fat actually shouldn't be a descriptor that means anything other than fat. But that people respond to those articles with this sort of real vehement kind of anger and hatred over the idea that fat people could possibly want to dress in a way that makes them feel good or makes them look good, in the same way that anyone else who fits into a size off the rack should have that right to do. Why do you think it offends people on such a deep level?
I mean, it's not, and of course it's not just fashion, that this, some of the emails when we announced the show, when we did the first call out to Nothing to Lose, which was 2.5 years ago, I had an artist page on Facebook, and I didn't realise that I still had the message me button on. And so we announced the show, and then I went about the day and then sort of logged onto Facebook, and I had 80 or 100 emails into my artist page from people who didn't know me. So, and some of them were positive, but a lot of them were positive, but I had some of the most hateful, vitriolic hate mail I have ever come across in my life. I got called the ISIS of the obesity epidemic.
Oh, I've been called the ISIS of feminism.
Oh, hey!
High five.
Go us.
It's like obesity and feminicism.
Feminicism is hilarious. And so that was really... full on. And we actually used a lot of that text in the show. So sucked in whoever wrote that. But they're probably not going to see the show, unfortunately. For me, I have a thick skin. I have all that stuff. I'm used to it. It doesn't affect me like it did. I'm pretty tough. So I just go, great material. You can't write, couldn't pay to write this shit. This is amazing. So, similar to how I guess you might have reacted to that poster, it's just kind of like, wow, But it's interesting, like, when you talk about this idea that, people see fat bodies because we're so visible, you know, we're visibly fat people, that it seems to give people permission that they think that we're public domain and that everybody has the right to have an opinion around a fat body.
Particularly
fat women's bodies. But also, you know, it's, yes, particularly around women's bodies, but I have experienced through the making of this show specifically when we did the call out, how we worded that call out to audition for this piece was incredibly interesting. We could write a whole thesis on the call out actually for this show, because we wanted to invite people of size, fat people. You know, we definitely wanted a specific body shape to audition, and we wanted to encourage people who may not have engaged politically in their size, who were bigger, who loved dancing. We didn't want to offend people. We didn't want people to feel put off by just saying, we want fat dancers. Like, if I saw something that said, I want, like, audition for fat dancers, I'd be like, what is this, like, you know, that show that came out called Dance Your Ass Off, which was about being an amazing fat dancer, but you only won if you lost the most weight. It was like, yeah, we're amazing fat people, now get on the scales. I don't know if anyone saw that. It was like the biggest head fuck, but anyway, I think we were very clear to be as respectful and open and non-judgmental as possible, to be really like, we understand that not everybody relates to the word fat, and people don't identify as fat, so we're very broad literally in our description. Even within that, we still had a 95% female applicants only, and that to me speaks volumes around the rhetoric around fat and size and the words and how we use that language. So yes, it is. And then we have gone and found masculine people who feel like they're part of the show and identify as fat, but it was much, much harder. So it's been interesting talking to them about their experiences, and interesting that we had not one straight cis fat man apply. So, you know, I think that's something around queering fat bodies and how we relate to each other, and how that sort of intersection of queer bodies and fat bodies work in how we identify is something that I find really fascinating. I kind of went really off topic then, but anyway.
Well, no, just briefly as well, I wanted to raise the issue of sex as well with everyone on the panel, and I wanted to ask you identify as a queer fat femme.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask whether or not you think that there is bigger space, boom, for queer fat bodies to be able to express themselves. I mean, in terms of social perception, to be able to express themselves sexually, as opposed to being in a very kind of rigid sort of heterosexual framework.
Yes. So there is. I think that, you know, when I really started to investigate body politics and fat politics, it was when I came out as a queer femme. So, and for me, the two are incredibly linked and I can't separate them. And I kind of learnt to sort of unpack the kind of, you know, onslaught of thought and policing and, you know, the intersections of body politics through a queer lens, through a queer femme lens. And so, I think that in some ways, I do feel like the creating of radical queer spaces that sort of look at gender and look at identity politics maybe more than in a heteronormative space, it does sort of lend to creating communities where bigger bodies, different bodies, you know, mid-gendered bodies, trans bodies, you know, are more kind of become more desirable, or that idea of sort of being in a body that's less than what's considered a heteronormatively attractive, hegemonically attractive body is sort of celebrated. Mm. So I think that for me, coming out as femme and fat at the same time allowed me to really sort of experience and investigate my sexuality. Mm. And, you know, and be encouraged to do so much more than if I much more, I believe, than friends I have who are fat, but in sort of more hetero situations, I believe. But that's my personal experience.
So. Thanks. I just wanted to note as well that very regretfully we don't have a disabled person on the panel with us tonight, but I would have liked to have had that discussion about disabled bodies, particularly disabled women's bodies in terms of inclusivity and also sexuality. I was friends with Stella Young, who passed away last year, and she and I used to have a lot of conversations around the idea of women's sexuality when they were in disabled bodies and the total desexualization, as opposed to the elevation of men's sexuality when they were in disabled bodies. This kind of very sort of... a world that in the mainstream was opposed to sex work unless those sex workers were working with disabled men, and then it suddenly became a sort of a mercy mission. And wasn't it wonderful that these angels were delivering some kind of masculinity back to these men who'd been stripped of it because of the disability in their bodies? And yet that same discussion was never had around disabled women's bodies. And also, aside from that, this sort of like very patronising, offensive view that the only kind of sexuality that disabled people could possibly hope for would be one that was provided to them as a financial sort of exchange. And one of the things that Stella used to say to me was that in many ways she was kind of liberated from the expectations around women's bodies and the expectations around body image and conforming to a very kind of like conventionally attractive, heteronormative, hegemonic sort of idea of what an attractive body was, because her body was so far removed from that for all of the other issues that she faced with you know, bigotry and with being excluded from so much of the world and the way that it worked, that was one way that she kind of had a bit of freedom to work within that. So it would have been, I just wanted to acknowledge that there is that huge discussion to be had, but obviously we can't have, all of the wonderful diversity on stage that we would like. So I just wanted to move on to Karina and Alice. I mean, Alice, you're pregnant at the moment. And again, acknowledging that not all women can have or choose to have children, but that having children is a choice that a lot of women make, and the judgments that are made around pregnant women's bodies before and after birth are huge and quite different in terms of how people perceive those bodies. So I wanted to talk to you in terms of, Alice, you are in that mode of being pregnant right now, and Karina, you've had two children and since had a hysterectomy as well. So I just wonder what... thoughts you might have, Alice, on the way that people are treating you now that they perceive that you're pregnant and therefore there's something else going on with your body.
Oh, well, we were just talking about this in the green room with Corinne as well, and I acknowledge that not all women find it easy to fall pregnant. Some women do. I was very lucky. Lorinda took me about 2.5 years to write, and when it was launched last year, you got a lot of congratulations, and I was very pleased, and I was very early in my pregnancy, so I didn't look that pregnant. But then when people found out that you are pregnant, you get the very same congratulations over a book that you took 2.5 years to write. Something that took you maybe half an hour and was a whole lot more fun to do. And it's the same. And I realised, wow, you just need to get knocked up and people treat you in a special way. They do. And then I looked back at all my friends I was growing up with, and, if you're stuck in a dead-end life and you're stuck in a very, either welfare existence or working-class existence, I understand why young women get pregnant at 16 or 17. Even in Braybrook and in Footscray, when you're pregnant, people treat you so much better. They treat you so much more sensitively. Your class maybe doesn't factor into it until you go to a suburb where people judge you for being bogan. But people treat you a lot nicer. And it's a completely different matter if you're 16 to 18 and your baby's born. Then they say, oh, look at you, welfare queen. But before that, a pregnant woman is always called beautiful. A pregnant woman is always, seen in a very special way. And it was when you're in the first 3 months, feels like a parasite. So you're really sick. You smell everything. I'd go to work and I could see who did a number two in each toilet cubicle purely by the nose, you know. It's terrible. But people expect you to, they'll say, look at you, you're glowing. And I think, oh no, I'm sick. And then the midwives will say, you can't call your baby a parasite. We'll send you some. They take it really seriously, which is a wonderful thing. They take, postnatal depression, and you have prenatal depression, which I didn't think I had. So, but you're just not meant to refer to. And at one point, it does feel like a tennis ball. My husband felt it and thought, ew, it's disgusting.
I used to say I was like Sigourney Weaver when I felt it moving. I was really convinced an alien was just going to shoot out.
Strange.
Well, Karina, you were saying backstage that you felt that Alice has talked about how kindly she's been treated since she's been pregnant.
Yeah.
And you felt that it made people see you differently and more somehow sensitively.
Yeah, it did. But I just remembered a really good story, actually. So people were really... I felt like I got a free pass to heterosexual world, which was really interesting. I went through a stage of getting my eyebrows waxed and I was lying on the beautician's table and she's like, oh, my God, have you seen Brad Pitt in that new movie? And nobody has ever asked me to talk about a hot guy before. And I just played along. I was like, yeah. So I just wanted to feel what that het privilege was like, and it was kind of nice. I just didn't feel... Yeah, there's a certain level of just feeling a little bit freakish when you're with beauticians. But maybe all people feel that.
Yeah, we all feel that.
We all feel that, yeah. Good. I'm so glad about that. I've been feeling awkward on beauticians' beds since I was 13. Anyway, so I was in a doctor's surgery and I've got some RSI stuff and I had to go for a work cover thing. It was in Little Collins Street. There was lots of gold everywhere, old white guy in a suit. And I was quite pregnant with my first baby. And he was like, okay, and blah, blah, blah. And you're obviously pregnant, yep. And what does your partner do? I go, my partner, blah, 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 and dropped a female pronoun in there. And he just went, well, how did you get pregnant? And I kind of was like... really deeply shocked, and then going, my next work cover payment depends on how I treat this situation, right? So afterwards, you know, you have all the good responses, and I wish I'd said something like, obviously it was the Immaculate Conception. I'm sorry, have you not been to medical school? So,
or
there's a sperm and there's an egg, and I just kind of did a sort of, I really don't think that's any of your business. And he went, whoa, you know, and then was extra nice to me after that. But people really would, and so many people have just like, I know I really shouldn't ask you this, but like, how did you do it? You know? And I've been called an oversharer all my life. So I'm quite happy. I just go, yep, sit down, let's go. And I tell them the whole lot. And so till the point where they get a bit squeamy and funny. Because I think, well, if you're going to ask me that question, you've got to get a real answer. But.
Just in reference to your choice, I don't know whether or not it was a choice or whether or not it was a medical necessity to have the hysterectomy. I know that you've written about it.
Yeah.
How has the medicalization then of your body affected your perception of yourself?
I started thinking I was trans not long after I had a hysterectomy. Interestingly, I've just been reading some new research on the gradation of biological sex. So I think everyone's aware that gender identities live on a spectrum, but very few of us are aware that the way that our genitalia is also on a spectrum. Most trans people are aware of that, but most cisgendered people aren't. They think you're either born a male or a female and that's it, and that gender identity is something else that kind of lays over the top of it.
And this person was saying that they think polycystic ovarian syndrome is a form of intersex because of the extra androgens that you have. So you have a lot more male hormones when you've got PCOS, which is really interesting for me. But and the point where I actually thought I might be trans was after I'd had the hysterectomy, I'd stopped bleeding. I didn't realise that bleeding and carrying a uterus and having a cervix that opens and closes. And I've just started teaching first years again this semester, and today one of them said, "What's a cervix, G?" It freaked me out. I felt so sad for her. Anyway, I nearly said, "Honey, can you come and see me later because we need to have a talk?" But it's not my job. I'd stopped bleeding. I felt like there was kind of a hole there. And I was going to Lords of the North, which is the most ace barber in the world. And it's the first place I've ever found that will give me a men's haircut without charging me $120 because I'm not a man. And they do a thing where they shave the back of your neck with a straight razor. And I just was like, I think I got to be a guy just so I can have a straight razor on the back of my neck and a hot towel. But it really shifted my sense of my gender, and I realised that for me, being a woman, whatever that meant, was tied up with having reproductive organs, and I have almost none now. Yeah.
A friend of mine, a few years ago, she identifies as a woman and is a cis woman, but is, you know, a queer woman. She had an elective breast removal surgery done, and because she did not identify with having these breasts, and she said that she experienced a lot of depression over it right from when she was a teenager and they first began to grow, and they didn't feel like they belonged to her body. But she found it incredibly difficult to find anyone in Australia who would perform the surgery, even though she was a 34-year-old woman. And the only way that they would consent to do the surgery was if she signed that she and had actually started taking testosterone and was going through a transition process, because the only way they would agree to remove her breasts was if she identified as being a man. And she ended up getting the surgery done and had it done in America with a doctor who's sort of considered quite progressive there, does a lot of these kind of surgeries, particularly for people from outside of America. But even then she had to undergo a psych assessment in order for him to be able to go through with the surgery. And the doctor that she was dealing with in Australia sort of really kind of pushed this, but you must be trans, because you don't want to have breasts, line with her. And she's like, no, I still identify as being a woman, I just don't identify with the breasts that I have. And he ended up saying something to her along the lines of, you know what, I'm going to give you the permission because I like you. Which she was obviously huge, almost had a similar experience that you did with your doctor, where she was kind of torn between saying, that's one of the most unprofessional things I've ever heard, and also, I need this consent because I need to have the surgery done so that I feel like I am at one with my body. Mm. And the thing that she said to me in all of that, and all of that is shocking enough, but the thing that she said to me that really drove that home for me, this idea of the rigid kind of parameters of what women's bodies should look like, and that's from both a cis and trans perspective, is that she said, as a 34-year-old woman, I was not trusted to be able to make a decision about whether or not I wanted breasts. But if I were a 16-year-old girl, I could go and get breast augmentation surgery done without the consent of my parents. Yep. Because having breasts is considered to be so central to the experience and identity of womanhood, and not having them means that you must be something else. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're just going to go to questions now from the audience.
I'm interested to know your thoughts on all of the Love Your Body campaigns and the lingerie campaigns that come out with full-sized women and different figures, and whether you think they're great because they celebrate all different shapes and sizes, or if they potentially do more harm than good.
Kelly Jean?
I mean, I think that I have a love-hate relationship with that idea of that kind of advertising. I'm very sceptical around where that's being coming from. And also I think that, you know, there's quite often a lot of those campaigns that celebrate, like, the wonder of the human form actually mean? We celebrate cis white women who fit between a size 8 and a size 18 at the best. And I think that, you know, when they talk, when people talk about body love and size positivity, specifically, it's within a very white, you know, heteronormative context of what that means. And also, it's also what we call, what we, I don't know who the collective we is, what people and sometimes I call as small fatties. I am a very large fatty. And I think that that it's interesting because you actually brought up earlier when we were talking, Clementine, about Tess Munter. I don't know if you guys know who Tess Munter is, but the idea of this woman who is a model, she's just been signed to a mainstream modelling agency in the States.
I think it's Elite. I'm not sure.
Elite Models, right? Yeah. So like the big time, pardon the pun. And it's been so controversial because she's a big fatty. She's a big fatty. She's my size or thereabouts. And, you know, people are just outraged. But I think what's interesting about that is that only now are we sort of seeing actually like plus size bodies. Outside of what is considered, you know, I mean, if you think about in terms of fashion and dress size, you know, plus size is considered a size 18. Quite often plus size models.
Plus size is considered Robin Lawley.
Yeah, that's right. But I was just
like
going to say,
size
like,
12.
Yeah, so quite often plus size models are size 12s, but they've got big tits. And, you know, I'm a size 26, 28. And, you know, those sort of bodies, although helping some people, they say nothing to me. Not that there's anything wrong with having that body. God, that sounded terrible. I don't believe there's any wrong way to have any kind of body, but it doesn't say plus size or body diversity to me. So I think that although the intentions might be good in those kind of campaigns, I think they fall very short of the mark of what it could be to be body inclusive and body diverse. I don't think I'm yet to see something that that really says that to me, really, in terms of a commercial context. There's definitely art projects that are and photographic projects that come from people who do have a real sense of what body diversity means and trying to be as inclusive as possible. I just don't think they have a commercial sort of marketing. They come from a marketing space, if that makes sense.
And I think that that's an important differentiation to make as well, is that a lot of those campaigns are really there to sell products.
Yeah.
And so they're sort of exploiting the language around body positivity while not actually really testing the bounds of it.
I mean, a perfect example of that is that song All About That Bass, which every single person in the street sings to me constantly. And all of my mother's friends sent me a link to, which I thought was very dear. But if you listen to that song, what that woman is actually doing, A, she's quite small and white and blonde, and oh my God, we could talk for 45 minutes about how fucked that song is, but and the video. But what it's essentially is saying is that she's not. It's not about celebrating body diversity. That song's actually about shaming thin people, which is totally counterintuitive if you're going to talk about body politics and radical body politics. You know, I don't do what I do, and present myself in this way in order to shame anybody. That's not my motivation, and I really find that strange when people come from that perspective. I don't like to, you know, I wouldn't like to think that is something that should be celebrated, but people really think that song's like this amazing pop song about like body self-love, and I'm just like, have you listened to the words? Like,
and all of that... Karina.
That's all right. Those ads get shared a lot on Facebook, the Love Your Body, and that exhortation to women, and it's always to women to love their bodies, is assuming that we don't already love our bodies. And so,
and that someone else or a company has to give us permission to do
that's
that.
That's right. And it's also self-congratulatory, and it's like, aren't we amazing because we noticed that there was someone that wasn't a size 8 and now we're going to tell you to love yourself. It's like,
because you kind of look like them, but you actually really don't.
Yeah, if you
want to
have body diversity, dude, have body diversity. Don't make a big song and dance.
And also
giving permission to people to love their bodies. It's really interesting that there's also been, you know, some stuff written lately about how when women actually say, "But I don't feel like I need permission to love my body. I already love my body." Oh, think pretty highly of yourself, don't you?
Exactly. Or It's a, and also like it's kind of this thing of like that loving your body is this destination, and then once you get there, you're fine, and but like you're never going to ever go anywhere else. And like I think that's completely unrealistic to think that like people, you know, apart from being like you're so brave and where do you get your confidence from, and you know, wow, people are often just assume that I don't have any kind of oscillations around my relationship to my body as a fat activist or as a unapologetic fat person. And I think that's really, you know, that's really unreal. A, it's unrealistic, and it's also silencing to the kind of realities that we all have living in this world where all of our bodies are under constant scrutiny. I think it's important to talk about the need to love yourself and have this like respect and honouring of who we are and all our glorious, wonderful diversity, but also to acknowledge that it's not a steep incline and then you get to the top and you're fine. It's like you constantly have to engage with yourself and where you are in the world on an hourly basis. You know?
And that also comes back to the idea of redefining beauty, that redefining beauty is always defining it in terms of how heterosexual men view women. Yeah. You know, that this idea that you should love yourself is never about anything other than that you should welcome an admiring male gaze on your body.
Yeah.
You know, and then hey, it's great because we've just widened that objectification out now, so that everyone can be a part of it. You know, it's why you hear things like, oh, well, men like women with meat on their bones, or you know, or only dogs like chewing bones. I mean, the whole thing is about this real kind of shaming and elevating women above other women for this sort of like reward of male attention.
Yeah, and it just lets the chubby chasers like run amok as well.
Lady in the middle.
In and of itself a bit of a... Right.
Anyway. I just wanted to throw into the discussion the idea of body hair when we talk about bodies, and that's like everyone has hair everywhere in their body, and it's quite controversial, especially for women, I guess, to take ownership of body hair, really. And I just wondered what your thoughts were.
One of the things I love about having two boys, and lots of same-sex female couples have boys, and it's actually a fact because we are really hardcore about insemination and timing. And boy sperm, if you don't know, boy sperm swim faster, die sooner. Girl sperm or X, whatever the right terminology is, live longer, swim slower, right? So we do actually tend to have boys because we inseminate right on ovulation. And I love that my two boys, regardless of who they are when they grow up, so my partner and I walk around naked sometimes. We have showers with each other. And these boys look at our bodies, and we're both decently sized girls with really hairy legs, hairy armpits. I've got two nipple piercings. We're both quite heavily tattooed, and go for them. So, you know, you have this thing in your head that takes a category, and so you think dog, and everyone's got a dog in their head that is the... It's got a supernome. That's the example of dog for you. Bird is whatever. For them, woman is heavily tattooed, pierced, really quite hairy, large women who... And then when they put their clothes on, they mostly wear jeans and boots. And I just think there's a lot of boys growing up with a different conception about what women look like, what they do. And I'm not saying that that's only coming from same-sex attracted parents either, okay? I'm saying that we're starting to show body diversity, we're starting to have broader categories, we're starting to do different things with our bodies that mean children are witnessing, they're getting different supernomes in their heads, basically. And I love that. Apologies to the Auslan interpreter for supernomes.
This has been really interesting. It also relates to the first question where you asked if we saw ourselves in, you know, media campaigns about loving yourself. Now, it's very problematic for a woman like me before I was pregnant, as with quite a few Asian women I know, we have fewer, our body hair is a lot less. And secondly, before I was pregnant, I had the body of a 12-year-old boy without a dick, you know. I was very flat-chested, very small. And I thought, do I want to see this small person represented? Because there are lots of creepy, pedophilic people out there, you know. It's so you have this thing where In Australia, I buy all my underwear from Target, from the kids section, the 12-year-old kids section, and it's great because I can get a pack of 10 for 10 bucks. And then you go to Asia and everything is padded. You got, what do you call it, bras with two soup bowls, cups there. And so there's this idea of femininity in Asia that replicates this white, cis, heterosexual femininity to the point of getting blue eye contacts, whitening your skin and looking like an anime character, which is an Asian man's dream of what a white woman looks like, and they expect Asian women to replicate that. So it's very interesting.
Do you experience discrimination in the queer world? If so, what impact does it have on you?
Do I experience discrimination in the queer community?
In the queer world, in the queer community?
Yeah.
If so, what impact does it have on you?
Not particularly, Tom. Not particularly. I don't know. Maybe I just hang out with really awesomely cool people. And that's it. And I'm not saying queer community is a Shangri-La where everybody loves each other divinely and is ultimately accepting, because I've had some really shit times in the queer community. But at the moment, and I turned 40 last year, and I think I just got sick of hanging out with people who weren't very nice to me. So, yeah. I hang out with good people now and that doesn't happen. Sometimes I get weird things on my website, and that's not queer community, that's just random people being random. And I just try not to cry. I cry very easily. So I know. I'd love some of your thick skin, actually.
Oh, I cry all the time.
So part of... Right, okay.
I'm like, I'm fine. Fuck you.
We're going to have to very, very sadly bring it to an end there. But could you please just join me in thanking the panellists, Kelly Jean Drinkwater, Karina Quinn, and Alice Pung.